This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. Hockey has had both an enduring but also a complicated relationship with understandings of Canadian identity. While not every Canadian skates or plays the game or even cares about the game, the sport itself occupies a serious place in the Canadian cultural psyche. While the game has often been seen as something to unify Canadians or to express Canadianness, whatever that is, it has also been exposed for very serious flaws in its culture, its infrastructure, and its dubious place as a game of character and of inspiration for Canadian youth. The game of hockey, as we understand it now, has undergone dramatic challenges and changes since its first official appearance on ice in Montreal in the 1870s. This episode today seeks to understand some of the key developments in the game that we now recognize today, from the rules to the rink size to professionalization, commercialization, internationalization, to the broadening of the hockey cultural mosaic. From its amateur roots to a game that is international in its appeal, incorporating men and women from different socioeconomic classes and ethnic groups, and one that continues to evolve alongside modern value systems while evoking serious discussions on its relevance to modern Canadians. This is Season 9, Episode 14, Hockey, the Game as We Know It Today. Today's book recommendation is titled Canada's Game, Hockey and Identity. It is by the author Andrew C. Holman, published by McGill Queen's Press in 2009. The origins of the game of hockey are still debated, though most historians agree that it was a coming together of a variety of sporting influences, both European and Indigenous North American, that merged into the on-ice spectacle that was the first officially recorded hockey game in Montreal on the 3rd of March, 1875. Very quickly, the sport spread and popularized, especially after it became a featured event at the Montreal Winter Carnival in the 1880s. This yearly hockey tournament saw amateur teams from Quebec and Ontario competing against one another, and by 1886, demand for a more organized and regularized league and schedule culminated in the creation of the Amateur Hockey Association of Canada in 1886. The AHAC sought to regularize the rules of the game, and until it was dissolved in 1898, it was the major authority for the sport in the country. It was also at one of the Carnival Games where then Governor General Lord Stanley witnessed his first hockey match. 3 years later, he donated the Stanley Hockey Championship Cup, the Stanley Cup, to be awarded to the best amateur hockey team in the Dominion. With Montreal at the center of Canadian hockey, the game spread rapidly from east to west. By the turn of the century, there were hundreds of amateur clubs across the country. In the more temperate West Coast, hockey was a bit slower to be picked up as the weather made outdoor rinks difficult to maintain. But in 1911, the Patrick brothers opened the first indoor rink in Western Canada with their Denman rink in Vancouver. This is where the 1915 Stanley Cup winners, the Vancouver Millionaires, played out of. So, 4 decades after the first official hockey game being played, the sport of hockey had become a popular winter activity for Canadians across the young nation. But what did the game actually look like? For much of these early years, the sport was played quite differently, depending on where you were and what organizational body you followed. Let's start, for instance, with the puck. In 1875, it was a small wooden block. 1 year later, Montreal players began to experiment with a small disc of vulcanized rubber, which they made by slicing off the top and bottom of a standard lacrosse ball. The rubber puck became ideal for the sport, and soon companies like the Montreal Rubber Company were manufacturing pucks en masse. In 1875, it was 9 players a side that were using that very original wooden block, 18 players on the ice in total. In 1883, one of the Montreal Carnival teams could only field 7 players, or ice 7 players. Their opponents followed suit, and for years, 7-on-7 was how the game was played. In 1911, the National Hockey Association, one of Canada's earliest professional leagues, experimented with 6-on-6. This was in order to cut salary costs. Even though the league's agreement was that they would return to 7-on-7 for the playoffs, all of the teams felt that 6-on-6 led to a better game. By 1920, the Ontario Hockey Association had made 6-on-6 the official format, and the Pacific Coast Hockey Association, which was run by the aforementioned Patrick brothers, adopted the format as well. 6-on-6 was here to stay. Yet part of the discussion of how many players should be on the ice was accompanied by heated discussions over the size of the actual rink. For instance, Montreal's Victoria Rink measured 204 feet by 80 feet. In 1900, Quebec's hockey rules stated a rink had to be at least 112 feet by 58 feet. Even when the National Hockey League formed, and insisted that all rinks be 200 by 85 feet, other organizations still continued to insist on their own dimensions. Hockey Canada, back when it was the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association, always allowed for variations in rink size. Let's look at some other developments. In 1899, the Canadian Amateur Hockey League, this was the follow-up to the AHAC, adopted modern goal nets, replacing the traditional use of 2 simple poles, sometimes adorned with flags. In 1918, the NHL changed its rules to allow goalies to leave their feet, thus allowing for goalies to utilize the flop save. No rule changed the game more than the introduction of the forward pass. Yes, that is correct. You've heard me right. For decades, hockey players could not pass the puck forward. They could only do so laterally or backwards. In 1929, that changed when the NHL permitted a forward pass only within the same zone. This was then followed shortly by the modern offside rule to prevent players from cherry-picking or hanging out in the opponent's zone to await the arrival of their teammates. In 1939, this rule was further refined with the introduction of the tag-up offside rule. one of the coaches to advocate for the offside rule, his name was Lester Patrick of the New York Rangers, also began to experiment with the idea of lines, having specific sets of players play together to create specific tactical advantages. Patrick advocated for shorter shifts, so 2 minutes a shift by this point, where the lines could exploit their opponent's weaknesses while maximizing their own advantages. Clearly, the game of hockey as we know it was evolving gradually over time. One aspect that was perhaps the most controversial in the early decades was the evolution of hockey from a purely amateur sport into a commercial professional product. In the very earliest days of hockey, the sport embraced the philosophy of the gentleman amateur, an arena where young, middle-class white men could demonstrate both physical prowess but also respectability, almost a 19th-century version of chivalry in the embracing of fair play and self-discipline. This did not last, because not long after hockey began to spread across the country, many saw the opportunity to capitalize on its growing popularity, i.e., money entered the equation. It's really, however, with the advent of indoor ice rinks, which proliferated after the First World War, that the commercial aspects of the game really began to be exploited. In the early days, hockey teams would charge the players themselves, so the members of the hockey club, to cover things like traveling expenses, equipment costs, etc. But as certain clubs became more and more popular, rink owners, indoor mostly, but still some outdoor, it should be noted, began to charge people to watch the games. Teams then began to demand a percentage of the gate, so a percentage of the money made on said ticket sales. At the same time that this was happening, various towns and cities across the land began to invest in their hometown team. A winning hockey team was the sign of a winning city. Having a team that could win, and even one that could challenge and capture the Stanley Cup, could boost that town's public image. Thus, if the local team like the Kenora Thistles, who were Stanley Cup challengers from 1903 to 1907, decided it needed to import some high-caliber players, and those players needed to be paid to be imported, by God, they would do so. Now, these teams were not in professional leagues, as we might understand it today, but a trend was obviously occurring. Teams wanted a cut of the profits that rink owners were making. Some of that cut could be used to financially entice high-caliber players to join the team, thus boosting that team's draw, boosting that team's popularity, and maybe allowing it to bring in even more high-caliber players, and on we go. Early professionals, or mercenaries, as many in hockey like to call them back then, such as Sprague Cleghorn, Bad Joe Hall, and Fred Cyclone Taylor, were all part of this early trend. Now, amateur organizations fought desperately against this professionalizing trend. As early as 1886, the Amateur Hockey Association of Canada prohibited professionals from playing in its league. The Ontario Hockey Association, which formed in 1890, followed suit. These leagues were also very popular. In fact, the OHA was one of the most influential early hockey leagues of its kind. While the amateur organizations certainly had influence and drew large crowds to their games, professional leagues began springing up across the country regardless. The Ontario Professional Hockey League formed in 1908. The National Hockey Association formed in 1909. This became the National Hockey League in 1917. And the Pacific Coast Hockey Association formed in 1911. And these were some of the most prominent, though not the only, early professional organizations. Slowly, over the course of the 20th century, the professional and amateur leagues learned to exist side by side. Yet what's fascinating is that even in the professional leagues, the salaries were not nearly as large as they are by modern standards. For most professional players, the salaries gave you enough to live, but certainly not enough to catapult a player into the economic 1%. Now this started to change in the 1970s. Television revenues began to increase dramatically in that decade, which in turn gave players more bargaining leverage as NHL teams were able to increase their own profits via this television revenue. However, even more important to increasing salaries was the introduction of free agency. You see, up until 1970, a reserve clause existed in the NHL whereby owners had the exclusive rights to re-sign a player after his contract expired. When this was challenged aggressively by the NHL Players Association and abandoned by a rival professional league known as the World Hockey Association, the writing was on the wall and the reserve clause was scrapped. Because of this, players now had even greater bargaining leverage with teams. They could effectively say, I don't want to play for Team A if Team B will pay me more money. With the abandonment of the reserve clause and the introduction of free agency, salaries began to increase, at first at a slow, but then at a faster and faster rate. But it wasn't just salaries that were on the rise. Another aspect of the game that began to generate money was equipment. As early as the 1880s, sporting goods stores began to appear, such as Montreal's Whitman's Sporting Goods, advertising hockey equipment to all players. In 1897, the Harold A. Wilson Company started advertising hockey products in Toronto. In 1949, Leopold Drolet opened Sherbrooke Woodcraft Sticks, which became Sherwood in 1961. Of course, other major companies followed suit, Cooper, Canada Cycle and Motor, otherwise known as CCM, and also Bauer, were instrumental in advancing the technological designs of modern hockey equipment. One of the problems that emerged in the 20th century, especially for those companies now making money off the sale of hockey goods, was the growing controversy surrounding the game itself. For instance, Lord Stanley was criticized for allowing hockey to be played on the Rideau Canal on Sundays in defiance of the Sabbath. The Catholic Church railed against hockey as they saw it as a vehicle for English assimilation. During the First World War, Canadians questioned whether the sport should be played at all while the nation was at war, while others, of course, found it a helpful diversion. As mentioned prior, one of the largest public issues was the lament over the decline of amateurism in the face of growing professionalism and, of course, commercialization. Towards the middle of the 20th century, others began to criticize the sport, in particular the professional leagues, for exploiting Canadian youth. One of the big moments setting off this critique was in 1936, when the National Hockey League, by then the dominant professional league in North America, struck a deal with the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association that permitted NHL clubs to claim rights to amateur youth players. Players as young as 16 could now be signed to a recruitment contract, though players could be signed at an even younger age with their parents' permission. For instance, Bobby Hall became the property of the Blackhawks at the age of 14. This system, under heavy scrutiny by the Canadian public, was abandoned in 1967 in favor of a universal amateur draft, the one we still see today. Perhaps even bigger than the loss of the amateur ideal or the exploitation of Canadian youth was the fears that hockey was becoming a conduit for Americanization, an ironic fear considering that Quebec felt hockey was a conduit for Anglicization. The game of hockey expanded across the border by the end of the 1880s and spread nearly as quickly east to west as it spread in Canada. By 1929, 6 of the 10 NHL franchises were American: Boston, Chicago, New York, the Pittsburgh Pirates, the Detroit Cougars, and the New York Americans. By the mid-20th century, this concern became even more overt as the post-Second World War America became a global juggernaut superpower. And I mean this economically, militarily, and culturally. By 1964, 4 out of 26 pro teams were Canadian. 3 years later, Vancouver's application to join the NHL was denied, and instead, 6 more American teams were added. It's important to note, too, that while the NHL was becoming an American-run corporation, it was staffed almost entirely by Canadians, players, coaches, equipment managers, etc., but not the owners. This feeling of American financial control of Canada's game and its players continued. In fact, one of the most infamous moments is the 1988 sale of Wayne Gretzky from the Edmonton Oilers to the Los Angeles Kings, a sort of metaphor for the commercial power of the United States. Even Walter Gretzky, that's Wayne's father, said of the sale, and I quote, "He, Wayne, is a Canadian institution, and what's Canadian should remain Canadian. You Americans think you can buy anything we have." Within Canada, however, there was also growing controversy and concern over the violent nature of the game itself. Certainly, from its very origins, there was a general acceptance that the game of hockey had to have some physicality. But how that physicality has been expressed over time has been the subject of much debate. As early as 1877, rules forbade charging from behind, tripping, collaring, kicking, or shinning. By 1900, the Ontario Hockey Association deemed cross-checking and pushing illegal. Since then, more and more has been added to the rulebook. In fact, as of 2018, the Hockey Canada rulebook has 11 pages explaining physical fouls. In comparison, stick fouls take up 4 pages.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey folks, I know that no one likes a good story being interrupted, and this is a good story today, but I have to interrupt you just to point out the fact that we do this show out of our own pocket, and it becomes very helpful when we get support from our fans. Now, I know that we also have commercials when we do our shows, and in fact, we rely heavily on the revenue from these advertisements to continue to bring you it. However, if you don't like listening to the advertisements, I have a solution for you. If you go to patreon.com/curiouscanadianhistory, you will find an option to get advertisement-free episodes. All you need to do is donate $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 to the show, and you will get access to these episodes. The nice thing is, Patreon has an app. It's easy to use, and it's kind of like your podcast app you use already. So you can just be on your phone or on your computer, and you can access those episodes advertisement-free. Go to patreon.com today. That's patreon.com/curiouscanadianhistory and sign up for advertisement-free episodes from CCH. Now back to our regularly scheduled program. Most historians agree that in terms of peak violence, hockey has witnessed 2 major waves. One in the 1900s, and another in the 1970s. The onset of commercialization of games and the professionalization of early hockey in the early 1900s began to, unsurprisingly, put a premium on winning. With this premium put on winning came the willingness to resort to violence to intimidate and defeat one's opponents. The game, by this point, had also gone well beyond its bourgeois beginnings and was being played not just by middle-class gentlemen clubs, but in working-class towns and neighborhoods throughout Canada. Many ice hockey players were tough, blue-collar workers who reflected a harsher industrial world. Sprague Cleghorn and Bad Joe Hall were 2 of the most infamous of this time. When we speak of violence in hockey, there are, of course, levels. There can be hard body checks, post-whistle skirmishes, dirty plays, fights, brawls, and then, of course, incidences where the stick is actually used as a weapon. The use of the stick in fights was so common during this period that deaths became a yearly occurrence. In 1905, Alcide Laurent from Alexandria, Ontario, was killed by a swinging stick during a brawl. 2 years later, Charles Mason of the Cornwall Hockey Club struck and killed Owen Bud McCourt of the Ottawa Victorias. Between 1905 and 1918, there were 8 episodes in Canada where hockey brawls resulted in off-ice charges of assault, 4 of those in 1907 alone. While many railed against what seemed like growing violence in the game, it was only after the First World War where this particularly violent period seemed to wane. Yet, the next wave returned with even more notoriety. Sparked by the NHL's expansion from 6 teams in 66 to 16 by 1972, along with the creation of its rival, the World Hockey Association, that same year, a new crop of players entered professional hockey, the Enforcer. Teams that were unable to compete in terms of talent now attempted to win through sheer physical dominance and intimidation. Perhaps no hockey event summarized this more clearly than the 1972 Summit Series between Canada and the Soviet Union. Despite the Soviet Union being a stronger team, and before people jump down my throat, what I mean is a stronger all-around team, not just individual hockey superstars playing together for the first time. Team Canada, being called so for the first time, resorted to brutalizing tactics to overwhelm the Soviets in a close-knit 8-game series. Perhaps no moment highlighted this more than Bobby Clark's two-handed slash on Soviet star Valery Kharlamov, breaking the Soviet star's ankle. While Canada ultimately won the Summit Series, in many ways this set the tone for the 1970s. The decade erupted into a flurry of on-ice violence, many of these incidences resulting in off-ice charges being laid. Teams like the Philadelphia Flyers played such an aggressive game, they were known as the Broad Street Bullies. Movies like Slapshot mocked the hyper-violent nature of the game. Over the course of that decade, more and more voices began to question the need for such hyper-violence. It wasn't just the NHL, after all, that was displaying this. Hockey at all levels was emulating what was being seen on TV and what was seen to be drawing crowds, and even what was seen to be working on ice. The bottom line was violence put butts in the seats and could potentially help win games, so owners were reluctant to do anything about it. Meanwhile, journalists, government officials, civic leaders all began to call for changes to the game. In 1974, the Ontario government launched a commission to investigate violence in amateur hockey in that province. The McMurtry Report, as it came to be known, did have some effect. The OHA implemented a 10-minute aggressor penalty for those who started fights. The NHL introduced a third-man rule in 1977 to penalize players who dangerously intervened in fights. Penalties for other violent infractions also became more stiff by the end of that decade. Certainly through the 1980s, wanton violence declined, though the role of the enforcer was still very prominent. All one needs to do is watch the Oilers of the 1980s, where Dave Semenko and later Marty McSorley ensured that Wayne Gretzky skated untouched by his opponents. In fact, during that decade, the public mood began to turn even more against violence in hockey. In 1987, the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association petitioned the CRTC, so the federal government's broadcasting regulator, to ban NHL telecasts if the league did not clean up its act. That same year, at the Canadian World Junior Championships, Team Canada was kicked out of the tournament after a brawl erupted against the Soviet team in none other than the championship game. In the public and press within Canada, Team Canada was criticized severely for their role in the brawl. Both violence and fighting have declined continuously since the late 1980s. Fighting is still, of course, a part of the game, though a part that is hotly debated amongst hockey aficionados. Wanton violence has certainly declined, though in a game that involves such physicality, it seems unlikely that it will ever be removed completely. Note, Marty McSorley's slash to the head of Donald Brashear in 2000, or more infamously, Todd Bertuzzi's attack on Colorado forward Steve Moore in 2004. In 2008, Don Sanderson, a player for the Whitby Dunlops in Ontario's Senior League, lost his helmet during a fight. In the course of the melee, he tripped, fell, hit his head, and went into a coma from which he never recovered. Shortly after this tragic event, McLean's magazine released an article titled, "Can We Please Now Ban Fighting in Hockey?" That debate continues to this day. While violence in hockey has certainly become wrapped up in the spectacle of the sport, perhaps one of the most overlooked aspects of the modern game is the announcing of it. By the end of the 19th century, not all hockey fans were able to see their favorite teams live, at the time the only way to see them, basically. Some way of translating those games to a mass audience had to be found. The earliest form of this for hockey fans was via the mass-produced daily newspapers of the time. While at first these reports focused around the local team, slowly but surely they grew to include hockey contests from across the country. A fan in Vancouver, British Columbia, could catch up on the scores of teams in Montreal. Along with this broadening national reporting scope, reporting moved from simply posting the scores and stats to greater effort in creating drama, identifying heroes and villains, favorites and underdogs, rule breakers, rule followers, etc., etc. Effectively, reporting on hockey morphed into more sensationalized accounts intended to engage the readership and sell more newspapers. Hockey games went from mere sporting matches to mini dramas played out on ice on an almost daily basis. As telegraph infrastructure spread across the country by the turn of the century, games could now be reported upon live. For instance, the 1896 Stanley Cup game between the Winnipeg Victorias and the Montreal Victorias, yes, same name, was the first game to be telegraphed live to avid fans across the country. Within a decade, sports-minded telegraph operators would relay the play-by-play messages via local radio signals, putting their own spin on the action. So basically, a location would be chosen for the telegraph messages to come in, and a broadcaster would then use considerable storytelling abilities to turn these brief telegraph messages into a running account of the game over radio. Now, live broadcasting of a hockey game, so we're talking about broadcasters being at the rink and actually watching the game themselves, first occurred in 1923 in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Canada quickly followed suit. Some of the first well-known radio play-by-play men were the Toronto Star's Foster Hewitt and the Ottawa Citizen's Darcy Finn. Both were originally sports reporters. Foster Hewitt, however, became the first true voice of the Canadian game. He broadcasted out of the Toronto station CFCA and in 1928 was hired by Conn Smythe to become the official voice of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Hewitt went on to set up his own production company, sold advertisement slots, and soon Hewitt's Maple Leaf games were picked up by 27 different stations across Canada. In 1933, these broadcasts became known as Hockey Night in Canada. In 1952, hockey watching was once again transformed with the introduction of the new medium of television. Interestingly, NHL teams initially forbade TV broadcasts for fear of it hurting live attendance, but there was no stopping the power of this medium. By the 1960s, the game was being produced with greater sophistication, so adding video replays, close-up shots of players, rinkside microphones, and multiple camera angles. Ralph Mellenby, who was the producer of Hockey Night in Canada from 1966 to 1985, won multiple Emmy Awards for his work on that show. While television brought the game into the homes of so many Canadians, perhaps one of the more relevant social and cultural changes to the modern game of hockey during this same period was the fact that barriers for persons of color and women were being significantly eroded. When one goes back to the middle-class amateur ideal behind the birth of hockey, One needs to understand that this was also rooted in an understanding of whiteness. Hockey was born white, and many believed this was how it should be. Non-white athletes struggled with the access to ice time, to the cost of gear, and the paucity of role models. While persons of color certainly played hockey since its early formation, the acceptance of non-white players was far more fragmented and uneven. Perhaps most people listening are familiar with Willie O'Ree, a black hockey player from Fredericton, New Brunswick, who broke the NHL's color barrier in 1958. Yet even before that, you had Woodstock, Ontario's Hipple Galloway, who played both organized baseball and hockey in the late 1890s. Stratford's Charlie Lightfoot, who was a contemporary of Galloway's. And London's Fred Kelly, who played a couple decades later. In 1948, Vernon, British Columbia's Larry Kwong signed with the Quebec Senior League's Valley Field Braves, and the Edmonton Journal described him as one of the few Chinese players to make good in organized hockey. For most of the history of hockey, non-white players have been portrayed as rarities or players used to contrast against the whiteness of the sport in general. Non-white teams became traveling spectacles through the first half of the 20th century. The Niagara Falls Swallows, who toured in 1937 and 1938, for instance, or businessman Willie Wu's all-Chinese-Canadian team that played in Montreal in the 1940s, or even the St. Catharines Orioles, who were contemporaries of the Swallows. Perhaps even more famous was the formation of an all-black hockey league in the Maritimes, which by 1900 had 7 teams. Amongst First Nations, the game of hockey was even more complicated. Many Indigenous persons attributed the game to First Nation roots, and thus the game itself was poised as another form of cultural appropriation by settler communities. Yet, for most, hockey's indigeneity was marginalized and forgotten. Yet, Indigenous players were present from the very beginning. Elmer Henry Bud Miracle played in Ontario in the 1920s before being signed to the New York Rangers in 1926. When he was finally called up from their amateur affiliate in 1931, he was the first Indigenous player to play in the NHL. Again, though, Miracle was identified more for his indigeneity and not simply for being a good hockey player. Miracle the Indian was the common moniker applied to him in the press. All Indigenous teams were formed and toured the country playing semi-pro and amateur clubs alike. Again, many of these were touted as novelties. The Kanawaga Hockey Club from Montreal South, or the Cree and Ojibwe Indian Hockey Tour, which played dozens of cities in the late 1920s. More complicated was the use of hockey at residential schools. Many of these teams were exceedingly strong teams and highly competitive against other all-white squads, like the Pelican Lake School Blackhawks, who played in Ottawa and Toronto in the 1950s. Yet, while so many residential schools boasted competitive hockey teams, it's important to note that hockey, like the schools themselves, were vehicles for assimilation and colonization. Perhaps equally controversial amongst hockey's patriarchal inner circle has been the emergence of the women's game. Though resistance to women playing hockey did not follow a straight course, women and girls could be seen skating alongside the men in the 1880s on the Rideau Hall rink in Ottawa. And in February of 1891, the first all-women's game took place there. Women's hockey spread fairly fast after this, so much so that by 1914, Winnipeg had an all-women's league known as the Telephone Ladies Hockey League. It seemed like the women's game was fairly widely accepted by this point, so we're talking towards the period of the First World War. During the interwar period, women's teams proliferated across the country. Community teams, workplace teams, university squads, etc. The Banff Winter Carnival hosted a women's tournament every year from 1917 to 1939. 1920 saw a Western Canadian Intervarsity Women's Hockey League form that included teams from the universities of Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and BC. A similar league formed in Ontario as well, but the most popular of the leagues was the Ladies Ontario Hockey Association, which saw strong attendance in that province for 19 years. In 1933, the Dominion Women's Amateur Hockey Association was formed, which oversaw a national championship game. It even had its own championship trophy known as the Lady Bessborough Trophy, which was donated by the wife of then Governor General Lord Bessborough. This championship saw the incredible streak of the Preston Rivulets, one of the greatest hockey teams ever formed in the history of this country, who won every Ladies Ontario Hockey Association title between 1931 and 1940, and the Lady Bess four times. Prior to the outbreak of the Second World War, one would have thought the women's game was poised to continue to be a staple of Canada's hockey landscape. But the Second World War brought all of that to a crashing halt. The general consensus was that women in Canada should be devoting their energy to wartime pursuits, from the domestic realm in the home, so rationing, victory gardens, care packages, etc., to the factory floor, and then even to the training grounds of the various military branches. To add insult to injury, the post-war push to revive traditional gender roles further prevented a return of women's hockey. While some women's leagues certainly remained, they were only a fragment of their former selves during this period, often cited as re-domestication. In this conservative period, one of the more scandalous cases occurred in 1956. This was when a young Abby Hoffman disguised her gender so she could play for the St. Catharines Teepees in the all-boys Little Toronto Hockey League. When she was found out, she was banned from playing the following season. The 1960s, with the onset of New Wave feminism and the sexual revolution, also helped bring about a revival of women's hockey, primarily in the college and university campuses as clubs, so not official varsity teams, but clubs. The graduates of the various university and college teams then went on to form small local leagues, such as the four-team Ligue Féminine de Hockey Le Canadien, based out of East Montreal. By the late 1960s, women's hockey was making a slow comeback. The Picton Provincial Women's Hockey Tournament, for instance, boasted 400 players. The 1970s saw women's hockey become more formalized within the realm of higher education, when women's hockey was officially readopted into the university sports program. And in 1979, the Labatt Cup, later renamed the Western Canada Cup, was created in the West for the Western Women's Hockey University Champion. In a bid for greater control over the women's game, 1975 saw the reemergence of the Ontario Women's Hockey Association, which sought to govern women's hockey outside of the structure of the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association. One of the major issues at stake during this period was that many talented girl hockey players sought to play against boys in order to play at a more competitive level. In 1976, for instance, a 13-year-old Montreal goaltender named Francoise Thibault was not allowed to play on an all-boys team because of her sex. She took her case to the Quebec Human Rights Commission, which ruled that it was, in fact, discrimination to not allow girls to play on boys' teams simply based on sex. In Ontario, in 1986, 12-year-old Justine Blaney was barred from playing on an all-boys team. The Ontario Human Rights Commission found that there were girls' teams that she could play on and thus did not rule in her favor. The Ontario Supreme Court backed the commission, but a last-ditch appeal to the Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that being barred from playing on an all-boys team because of one's sex contravened Justine's Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Despite these high-profile cases, by the early 1980s, girls' and women's leagues began to expand significantly across the country. In 1987, the Ontario Women's Hockey Association staged the first ever seven-team world tournament. Because of its success, the International Ice Hockey Federation sanctioned an official women's world tournament in Ottawa in 1990. A second tournament took place in 1992. And in 1998, women's hockey was included in the Nagano Winter Olympics. While the professionalization of the women's game has encountered problems, the failure of the National Women's Hockey League in 2007 and the Canadian Women's Hockey League in 2019, the current professional women's hockey league is coming out of the gate hot with strong attendance and good media coverage. A hopeful sign that women's hockey is stronger than ever and will remain so. Thus, the sport of hockey has developed in a variety of ways, from its rules to its rink size to its association with both English and French Canadian identity to who is included and who is excluded. The game of hockey has touched upon various aspects of the Canadian historical memory, from multiculturalism to settler colonialism to commercialism, war and conflict, and even fears over assimilation and Americanization. While today, one could argue that hockey no longer holds the preeminence in terms of sports, it is difficult to argue that the sport hasn't been a central component of the development of Canadian sport and culture since the end of the 19th century. One thing is for certain, hockey continues to occupy an important space in current ideas about Canadian culture, Canadian sport, Canadian entertainment, Canadian identity, and is very often a lightning rod for very serious conversations about Canadian values and what it means to be Canadian. I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBorys. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.